A man with nothing that he loves is a man cannot be bargained. A man that cannot be betrayed. A man who answers to no one but himself. And that is the man that I see before me. A free man.
Hi, this is Victoria DeMar, star of Werewolf in a Woman's Prison and Killjoy Goes to Hell. You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
Freeze and your liver quiver. You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
Would you like some vodka with that?
Yes, it's Casey Ferguson here, are the canon films of the podcast world, with another ear-splitting entry of your erogenous zones.
Oh, yeah.
It's oral pleasure beyond measure, and what a way to come out of the gate from the new album The Missing Piece that was LA Guns, with Speed kicking off the show. Now, those of you who have been listening to this show for a while know that this is generally where I tell you who is going to be on the program and how great it's going to be, blah, 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 blah. But chances are, if you're listening to this, you already know who the fuck's going to be on the show, and all efforts have been made not to suck. And to be quite honest, I don't know who the fuck is going to be on this show as I'm recording this. I've been doing a metric shit ton of interviews, and there's still fuckloads of conversations that may or may not happen before I hit my deadline for this episode, so I've decided I'm going to get the party started and worry about who shows up after the punch has been spiked and the music has been cranked. I can tell you that I'll have some stellar songs for you, courtesy of Janet Gardner, Howling Giant, and Slide, among others. For now, though, I just want to get my spud-like torso in gear. This is Gutter Mouth on The Casey Ferguson Show.
move faster than men, be sure. They move that signal lure. With the blues I painted upon the chest, y'all keep talking about giving a rest. When you ain't funny, your time is up. I'll take this opportunity to wish you good luck. And I'm working my ass up from 9 to 5. Now I'm tough, but I'm killing with marks of supply. 1 and 1 and 2 and 1 and 3 and 1 and 4. You're the smart one who had to have more. 5, 10 and 6, 10 or 7, 10 or 9. You were put by torch, so it's left you behind. To separate yourself or pay the price. Quicker, that's for sure. Two in the house, worth one on the sewer. When you hit that, your time is up. I'll take this opportunity to wish you good luck. And I'm working my ass up from 9 to 5. Now I'm tough, but I'm killing with marks of supply. 1 and 1 and 2 and 1 and 3 and 1 and 4. You're the smart one who had to have more. 5, 10 or 6, 10 or 7, 10 or 9. You were put by torsos, left you behind.
You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
Yeah, so does your dad's brother.
You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
We'll be right back.
with tasses and emptying glasses, you are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. From their brand new album, Put 'Em Up, that was Channel 3, She Never Wanted It This Way. Before that was Debt Neglector, On the Brink, and at the top of the set was Guttermouth with Spud Like Torso. Speaking of torsos, I don't even think there's going to be a torso left if Sears doesn't get their shit together on the quickness. The company has definitely lost its heart and its head, and it's getting to the point where I think people are so angry with these devious dollar-crazed wand fondlers that they're going to burn whatever sad remains are left after the courts are done with them. Dig on this news story from CBC. After getting flooded with angry comments about its treatment of laid-off workers and by calls for a boycott, Sears Canada is no longer allowing public posts on its Facebook site. The retailer also appears to be in the process of removing all current comments voicing opposition to their unethical business practices.
Assholes!
The retailer announced last month that as part of a court-supervised restructuring process, it's closing 59 of its 255 stores and laying off 2,900 workers, none of whom will get severance pay. Sears has also requested court permission to stop topping up the underfunded retiree pension plan. The retailer recently agreed to postpone that matter until September 30th. Many Canadians have voiced their anger on Sears' Facebook site and said they will no longer shop at its department stores, adding to what one retail analyst called a PR nightmare. Most of the bitter comments are now gone from the site, but according to Sears Canada, they were not what motivated it to prevent people from making public posts.
I believe that when my shit turns purple and smells like rainbow chocolate.
In order to listen and hear from our customers most effectively, we're opening Facebook messaging to our customers and all Canadians with inquiries, Sears said on its site. We will, for the time being, close comments on our public feed to concentrate on responding to messenger inquiries.
The retailer also encouraged people to continue with their comments using the private messaging format. Yeah, I wouldn't want the world to see how little you care. Oh wait, it's too late.
We are focused on making Sears Canada a successful business, and so much of that relies on your feedback, it stated.
As long as you can control that feedback, right, Sears? You money-grubbing merchants of dipshittery? Do you really think you're fooling anyone?
You're deceptive.
Sears Canada told CBC News that deep financial troubles left it with no choice but to seek court protection from its creditors while it restructures. Yeah, because this obviously came out of nowhere. As part of the court proceedings, the company said it's not able to make payments to a number of stakeholders, including laid-off workers, owed severance. Sears, what you're doing is beyond morally fucking repugnant. You should be ashamed of yourselves, you slimy job-cutting turbo twats. What a fucking rat hole. This is Janet Gardner on The Casey Ferguson Show.
Tara Spencer-Nairn from Corner Gas, and you are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show.
You wonder and bring in the thunder. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. Ottawa's own Slide there with Divide. Before that, from a new self-titled solo album, was Vixen's Janet Gardner with Rat Hole. You know, Wildcats, I've been doing a lot of cleanup work lately. Be it here at Motel Ferguson or just life in general, things have been in fucking shambles and it's time to get out with the old and in with the new. So, although I've done a lot of interviews recently, I think it's time to get to something else I've been putting off. Playing you the final part of my interview with MMA legend and former WWF superstar, Dan the Beast Severn.
I think his name is Mother Shabubu now.
Shit, it's been about 2 years since I interviewed Dan, and while I've played pieces of that interview on a few different episodes now, there's still more to get to. Fuck man, Dan and I were having a blast, so we spoke for probably about 2 fucking hours, and even after editing, that's a lot to play for you, so I've been spacing it out. Well, I have one final part of our conversation to play for you, and I think it's about goddamn time. So here it is, the final part of my interview with UFC legend and Hall of Famer Dan the Beast Severn on the Casey Ferguson Show. Hey Dan, so you're one of only three fighters
ever to have over 100 victories in mixed martial arts. I was hoping that you could talk about your mindset competing against someone you feel is better than you, such as in your amateur wrestling days when you faced Larry Habilov.
Yep. I mean, a Russian wrestler, basically, I think he ended up winning 4 or 5 combination of world titles and or Olympic titles. At the time, he only had won 1 or 2 at that point, knowing that I'm about to step on the mat with someone who is better than me. Now again, I've been to Russia a number of times, but I've been to Russia way back in the mid-80s when it was known as the Soviet Union. So during the Cold War era, again, I learned quite well what the word propaganda meant at that time, how other countries used it, how our own country used it to control the masses. So anyway, I'm over there in Russia, and I mean, the Russians were, and in my opinion, still are the toughest wrestlers. It's just because of how that country kind of got broken up into other smaller type countries. And when it was known as the Soviet Union, it was a powerhouse in the sport of wrestling. But the incentive, that's what it would boil down to, the incentive. If you could make, you know, their, one of their national teams, and you got the chance to leave the Soviet Union and now go to some other country, like if they could come to the United States, they were blown away because they'd be flown into one city and literally they're like, there's no way that you have this many cars. They actually were thinking that everyone was driving all the cars that were in this city and they're driving all over to the next city because they just couldn't believe how much abundance that there were.
Right.
And it'll be very difficult for a lot of Canadians and Americans to actually to understand that. But you know, I tell people, like the very first time I went to Russia there, I knowing that they wouldn't believe me, I actually brought back a roll of their toilet paper, Casey, of all things.
It's like sandpaper?
You know that look that most of these Russian men had, that grimacing type of look of stuff like this. I go, if you had to wipe your hind end with this, you would have that look too. You know?
Yeah, you'd look like Ivan Drago as well, yeah.
I said, this stuff is 80 grit sandpaper at best here right now, you know? Most right now, yeah.
If that doesn't toughen you up, I don't know what will.
Exactly. But I mean, but even when, you know, the first time I was there, I won over more friends just by bringing, you know, you can buy these packages of stick gum that you could have 10 in a whole long, I don't think they even sell anymore, just the pack of 5 sticks of gum, but you'd have a whole string of them, like about 10 of them in a row. I won over more people just hitting a stick of gum to people. When I left the country, I gave people different types of things. They just, the way that they held it in their hand, it was like, you know, something I just gave them an ingot of gold or something like that, but it was just something of common sense that it just kind of boggled my mind because we take so many things for granted. Because even at that time, I began to go way back into Asia, I go, and people are bitching and moaning, I go, oh, obviously, go to a third world country. I go, Soviet Union is supposed to be a world power during that Cold War because, you know, they're puffing out the chest, posturing, yeah, we got nuclear power. The United States are posturing, puffing out the chest, yeah, we got nuclear power. Like 2 bullies on the block, you know, stand your side, we'll stand our side, blah, blah, blah. It'd be like, what a bunch of crap is all it was. I mean, when I first time I went to Soviet Union, it was one of the most impoverished countries I ever saw in my life. We could have sent our farmers over there bearing shotguns and could have cleared out that entire country at that point in time. To me, it's like propaganda bullshit.
Yeah, 100%.
And again, I went from city to city to city, and to get to it, the crappy road conditions, and then out in the middle of a field somewhere, you'd see a statue of Stalin or something like that, thinking, yeah, you must have been real proud of this country when you're running a regime right there, because I'm thinking it's just the place was just so impoverished. But once again, we're digressing, but it, you know, to step out of mat, I'm going to get someone I know that's way better than me, and I know that I'm not going to beat him based on technique. I have to beat him on a tactic, and that is the only weakness I'm aware of when it comes to Russians is they were not always known for their cardiovascular. So no matter what is happening, I'm going to be losing in this match, but I have to make my opponent expend as much energy as possible. Again, matches were different at this time period. They were three-minute periods long, and I think they're down to just two periods now. They're even longer early on, but at this time, there's three-minute periods with a one-minute break in between. And so my opponent is beating me 7, 8, 9 to nothing or something like this before I finally start, I score my first point. I got the first chink in his armor, and I'm just to push him to where, even though I'm sucking air because I'm pushing, because we're same weight class and he's powerful, stuff like this, but each time we go out of bounds, I make sure that I am the first person back to the circle and I'm waiting on him. So now in the eyes of the judges and that judge, he's slowing the pace on down. So they're starting to get after him, come on, let's go, because keep the action going. And then, I scored my next point. I finally tie him. I finally go ahead of him. I ended up competing against him, I think, three times and beating him all three times, including pinning him in his home city. In order to pin him in his own home city, I pinned him, which means they did not want to recognize the fact that what I was doing to their champion. And they were looking, the matches are looking away, they're not even recognizing it, because you had to get confirmation out of two of three of the judges. And I would only get one judge that would be like, he's out in the middle, he's like, well, he's got his flat, he's raising the hand, and the other judges are looking away, looking down like the tiny shoes. Like, oh, look, there's Elvis Presley or something like this. I mean, they're looking everywhere. Well, they should be looking. So, as I said, to do something like this, but it boils down to the mental mindset. And I think that's the one thing that really served me well through my competitions, but that really served me very well in my cage fighting career. The way that, the guy that's talking to you right now, nice guy, Dan Severn. Now, give me a couple minutes, coming back. Dan Severn went bye-bye. Now the beast is going to step out on the mat. I shake your hand before, I shake your hand after. No hard feelings for what's about to happen. I'll play within the rules, but you'd be surprised how I know how to bend them rules the same way I'm going to try to bend your body into a pretzel.
My God!
Well, and I think that speaks, that story speaks to your mental toughness. And people who don't watch MMA, like one of the common criticisms that I hear is, oh, well, it's the human cockfighting, or it's two guys pounding each other, and, it's going back to, the gladiators and, all that stuff. And I'm going, if you understood the chess match that is going on here, the strategy involved, like, whatever, it's kind of one thing, your first couple rounds or whatever, but when you see the mental toughness and the strategy really start to come into play, like, especially in the later rounds with a story like you're telling, I mean, to see the grit and the determination and the poetry in motion, it's one of the greatest sports in the world.
Oh, when you use the analogy of a chess match, I've used it so many times. I go, I think of mixed martial arts as a human game of chess where checkmate just hurts. That's all. Everyone's using their techniques, their tactics, and they have to do it all within the confines of these are the rules and these are our time elements, and so be it.
Well, Dan, now you're one of the, well, actually, you're the only person to date that has ever held an MMA title and a wrestling belt at the same time. So you've got an interesting perspective here. I've heard you say in an interview, that, am I not correct on that before I finish the question?
Oh, yeah, Brock Lesnar now. That is, he has, won a belt with the WWE and has done something in the UFC as well.
But not at the same time, right? Like, it wasn't simultaneous, correct?
No, actually, you are correct. I mean, literally, educate your listeners. When it was at UFC number 5, I was already the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance, heavyweight champion of the world for professional wrestling. And I basically had to get clearance with the ownership of the UFC at that time. And boy, they did not want to have nothing to do with professionals. They're like, that. They're like, Dan, we don't want to be known as the entertainment type aspect. I said, you guys don't understand the heritage of this belt. I said, you don't understand the integrity of me. I'm not going to put on a clown type of performance or something. I care too much about my, what I'm going to portray, so that there's not going to be any repercussions to my family, to my businesses and things of that nature, or to me. So, I mean, it took a little while and had to do a little negotiating, but they then allowed. And so I had one of the professional promoters take care of the belt on out. And then, you know, after winning UFC number 5, I held up both belts. And that was literally being the first person holding them simultaneously, a UFC belt and a professional wrestling world title belt.
You've got an interesting perspective. I mean, I've heard you say in an interview that you were hurt more in pursuit of one pro wrestling title than all three UFC titles combined. What do you say to someone who thinks pro wrestling's fake?
Well, yeah, well, I mean, that, you'll hear that all the time. I mean, because I'll have the four belts on display usually when I'm traveling. And now they all recognize the UFC, they understand what that is, and they're like, well, NWA. And they're like, well, what does that stand for? I go, well, National Wrestling Alliance. And like, wrestling, like what kind of wrestling? And I go, like, what you see on television? You know, WWE, TNA, used to be WCW, I could use as an example, but, or ECW, but they're all gone now. And they're like, going, oh, that, you mean that fake stuff? I go, well, I said, obviously you understand what these three belts back here represent. How is it I've been hurt far worse in my professional wrestling career than I have been in all of these three belts combined? And they look at me and go, well, how is that possible? And I go, well, the fact of it is this. I says, you know, professional wrestling may not be a real athletic contest. There's a predetermined outcome. It's a show. It's a movie. It's as I put it all the time, it's a male soap opera where these men, well, again, you got women in there too, but typically before it was a very male dominant type of a sport right there or entertainment product where men in tights get to settle their differences in the squared circle. And I go, it's an entertainment product. I said, but in a cage fight, all I got to do is walk out there and get results. The match can be done over in 10 seconds or less. Well, they go out there and get the knockout or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's done. Don't have to care about it now, but when you're putting on an entertainment show and you know that, Casey, you and your partner here, you have to put on a 15 to 20 minute match. What you're putting on this physical entertainment match, it's a game of give and take. It's a physical performance where basically you're telling a story with your audio, what comes out of your mouth, your facial expressions, and your body language, and what the outcome is going to be, because, you know, not all the matches can be the same, otherwise it's boring. So even the way the card is supposed to be put together, there should be different types of finishes in the matches, and not all the good guys can win. You got to have some bad guys that's got to be a win as well, because it creates the controversy so that you bring back people again and again and again to keep various storylines going along. But I always tell people, never discredit professional wrestling. Professional wrestling and mixed martial arts, they share the two common traits of there is physical preparation and there's a mental mindset. And you understand how that pertains to cage fighting. But also in professional wrestling, there is that physical preparation. These guys, a lot of guys, they're training, they're lifting weights, they have to learn the craft. But then there's a mental mindset. You have to become this character, whether it's going to be the good guy, the baby face, or the bad guy, the heel. And in the game of give and take, you know, you could be picked up, you could be bodily slammed, you could be hit with clothesline, you might get hit with a chair. And what people realize is it takes, every time you get picked up and slammed, your body is taking trauma. And at the time, right, when I first started working for the WWF, the average wrestler worked 187 dates.
Jesus.
Now that doesn't include travel to or travel back from. So 187 dates quickly moves into 200 plus dates a year. Now think about wrestling that many matches. You know, the hard thing is, and there's a category on the internet, it used to be type in professional wrestlers that did not live to see 40 years of age, and it's sad to see how many people have lost their lives in their 20s and their 30s before ever seeing 40 years of age. And a lot of it's due to chemical cocktails. Because of being on the road for that many matches, these guys need something to get them up and get going in the morning. So some type of amphetamine. They have to go to the gym to train. So now they're lifting weights, but you know, they know that, you know, I don't want to look like average. I need to get above average. So now they're taking steroids. They're taking growth hormones. Well, now you're doing these 187 matches. You're getting bumps and bruises and twists and cranks and injuries. So now you got to take painkillers, muscle relaxers, and now I need to get some sleep tonight, so I'm taking something to break me down, to put me to sleep. And you take all of those chemicals, and now you put a couple party favors in there, whatever your party favor is, and you wonder how your heart gives out. Because usually if you die at a very younger age, under 40 years of age, they typically have to do an autopsy. And then they start seeing an enlarged heart, this, that. So these are just telltale signs of growth hormones, steroids, things of that nature.
Dan, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you feel like talking about this, but did the WWF force you to withdraw from the Brawl for All?
When it was first announced, all the wrestlers were at whatever arena we were at. I don't remember where we're at, what city or state that we're in. But the call to order, all the talent was to be in the cafeteria. So as we're sitting in the cafeteria now you got a couple of the agents that are talking about this concept of this Brawl for All and how all the talent has got to be into it except for Ken Shamrock and Dan Severn. There was only two people that are not allowed to be in the Brawl for All. And so basically once I knew I wasn't into it, I basically left the meeting and that was it. So this is going on for a few weeks. I'm back relaxed. I'm using my duffel bag as my pillow. I'm relaxing, waiting to see if I'm going to have a match tonight or not. And I say it like that because you have an easel out there, and these are all the matches that are slated tonight. So you could be slated to wrestle tonight there, Casey, but all of a sudden, maybe Stone Cold Steve Austin's match against whoever went, 10 minutes over, and your match was slated for it, so they'll simply go up there with that duration, and your match is now gone. There are certain people that are the main characters of the professional scene, and then others that are just supplemental type matches that are not as significant. So you might be there in preparation of being wrestled, and also your match is scrubbed in the final couple minutes.
Well, that's got to be a pain in the ass after driving and everything.
Well, yeah. And again, they're all underneath contract, so they're all making X amount of dollars, regardless. So here I am. I'm just back there just relaxing. After this Brawl for All has been going down for a couple weeks now. And one of the road agents comes back to them and I go, hey Dan, how would you like to be in the Brawl for All tonight? I go, well, against who and for how much? And they go, Godfather and X amount of dollars. And I'm thinking, well, sure. And, I said, I really don't want to wear, I don't want to wear the gloves though, the boxing gloves. Well, he's like, well, you can't go and punch, go bare knuckles. I'm not going to ever hit him. I says, I want to show you and everyone else what a real wrestler can do. I says, I will go out there and the Godfather can try to punch me all he wants to do and he'll never touch me and I will wrap him up and I will throw him all over the place and I will twist him into knots. Because I know what my capabilities are. And that's where, kind of go way back earlier in our conversation, a lot of the MMA fighters today, they forgot where they came from. They forgot what was the strength that brought them to the table in the first place. I never forgot I was an amateur wrestler. And again, to have started a career at 37 years of age, where everyone else would have retired, that's when I started. So I only thought that I was going to do one event because I didn't know how it was going to go. Well, one event led to the next event, led to the first year, led to the fifth year, led to the first decade, led to boom. Because I'm not getting hurt and I'm winning match after match after match. So it's going well. It's a great little part-time hobby, a very well-paying part-time hobby. It's really what I looked at it as. So on Buffalo, I went out and I did my match. I ended up winning the match. And then as soon as I won it, okay, Dan, upper management decided to pull you out. So what I come up with is that, first off, what was really the concept behind the Brawl for All? I think a couple of the upper management, maybe even owners of the company, were bored one day as they're sitting on BSing and saying, who do you think is the toughest guy on our roster? And somehow they came up with this idea, let's do this concept of the Brawl for All. We'll put these 20-ounce gloves on all these guys and they'll go out there and they'll thump each other for 3 1-minute rounds and to see who the toughest guy is. And then these guys are probably even making bets on it and stuff like this. That's again, is what Dan Severn thinks is how that idea probably emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And probably as it's going on, a couple of people started doing a little braggocious and Shamrock or Severn should be in here. I'll kick their ass or something like this. I think probably some braggocious type of talk started to come out there and people, in the words of professional wrestling, Casey, some people were probably writing checks with their mouth that their body was not able to cash. And so then I think that's how I got into it in the first place. There were probably several people, probably including the Godfather,
get some.
They would not allow me to be without gloves. And really, I mean, that's one of those things where hindsight, I almost wish that when I went out there, I would have went out there and I would have, once I was out there in the ring, just tell the referee, take the gloves off. And I go, hey, it's live. It's live. I mean, they can't say nothing at that point. That I would have took the gloves off and I would have just taken hands at the moment. And I would have done that. I would have held my hands up, just open palm like that. Oh, I might have palm shot him once or twice because I realized in my early in my career, I was doing this shoot fighting or shoot wrestling career where you were bare knuckled, but you were not allowed to hit with a closed fist. You could hit the body with the closed fist, but the head only was allowed to be hit with an open palm shot. And I found out real quick, oh, if you hit with the meaty portion of that palm, you could throw a devastating blow and you'll never hurt your hand in the process.
Absolutely. So management pulled you out of the Brawl for All after you beat the Godfather?
Yep. It was just good baiting night, that's all it was.
Well, it's just, you know, if you're going to put something like that together, I mean, fuck, like, let the guys compete. I mean, you got a Dan Severn there, you've got Ken Shamrock. Like, if you're going to have a tough man contest and try to find out who the toughest guy on the roster is, put up a cage, do it UFC style, man, you know?
That was one of the things I believe why they brought us both in. I mean, Ken and I were being recruited at the same time. Ken basically went in almost a year ahead of me. He basically, but he was full time with them, and all the other WWF guys on his roster were restricted to only that one thing. As far as to my knowledge still, I am still the only professional wrestler ever to be on the roster that had no limitations. I could work for any promotion I wanted to. You know, I was working for 35 promoters in the NWA alone. I could have worked for WCW and ECW if I wanted to, and I think that was part of the problem that after they realized what they had negotiated, I think they did that to want to use me because I think they probably thought in their minds, well, if we put a strap on Dan and now he goes over to ECW or WCW, our biggest competition, and now he's made a mockery of or something like this, how is that going to make our belt look and how is that going to make us look? But at the same token, they were so concerned about themselves, they never looked into who is Dan Severn, what is Dan Severn all about. I was able to bring a professional belt into the UFC. You know, so to me, it's like, it just shows you the integrity and that I was going to do things with. I mean, even, you know, in the, again, I'll leave this for a teaser and we'll carry that to our next time we speak, but the cycle of a professional wrestler, if you're the good guy, they'll turn you into bad guy and vice versa, bad guy back into the good guy. You know, you think of Hulk Hogan. When he was wearing the red and yellow, he was Hulk Hogan, and all of this is by Byron Hulkamania. Drink your milk, take your vitamins, and your little Hulkers. I mean, he was doing all these types of things out there. I'm thinking, yeah, Hulk, I don't know what kind of juice you had in your vitamins, but they were pretty darn good ones. I don't think the rest of us could get that out of those Flintstone vitamins, that's for sure. But, you know, the thing is that, when they approached me about, you know, the cycle. I was known as a good guy, just a no-nonsense guy. I was wearing the same outfits I was wearing in the UFC and stuff like this. And now all of a sudden they're trying to pitch me with the idea of putting 666 across my forehead. Mark of the Beast. And making me an Undertaker disciple. To be continued.
This has really been a pleasure, man. I've had a great time talking to you. Thanks so much, fella. I will leave you be. Best of luck with everything, and keep in touch, my friend.
Will do. I enjoyed the conversation as well, though, Casey. You take care.
Oh, thanks so much. Cheers, Dan.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show.
I have soiled myself. How embarrassing.
That was the final part of my conversation with UFC legend and Hall of Famer Dan the Beast Severn. Be sure to keep up with Dan's mixed martial arts promotion on Facebook at Danger Zone MMA. While I'm on the subject, guess who did the theme song for Danger Zone MMA? I did, motherfucker. That's right, the first piece of music I've done in over 3 years was for Dan the Beast Severn. That's how much I like the fucking guy. So, if you check out one of their events or pay-per-views, you can hear me playing my Git Fiddle with Hank Rotz, the Lisping lyricist himself, on bass. Well, I reckon instead of just talking about playing music, I should actually fucking play some. This next band I'll have an interview with coming up on the print section of CaseyFergusonShow.com, so be sure to check that out in coming weeks. Their new album, Freak, drops September 29th. Here's a track from said record. This is Pull the Trigger by Tetrarch on the Casey Ferguson Show.
Pull the trigger, quit your whining little bitch, pull the trigger.
everybody. Kevin Mark from Candlebox here. You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
Save me from myself, and we hide away. gonna be right. 'Cause we are the echoes. Are you hearing me? Are you feeling me? Passing that we don't know. We're always outplayed.
Too hot to handle and too cold to hold, you were listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. From the forthcoming album Shadow Hearts, that was I, the Dreamer, with Echoes. Before that was Kingdom of Giants, Damaged Goods, and at the top of the set was Tetrarch with Pull the Trigger. You know what makes me want to pull the trigger? A little while ago, I decided I would drown my sorrows with a bottle of whiskey. Of course, by the time I had decided this, there was next to no time to make the liquor store. I weighed my options, and faced with the terrifying thought of sobriety, I begrudgingly called a local delivery service, knowing that it was going to heap on an extra $6 to the price of the hoot. Undeterred, I place my order. About a fucking hour later, the delivery guy finally arrives with my precious bottle of gut rot. I quickly paid the man and turned to begin my journey on the rock and roll pain train. This is when it happens. If it were a sporting contest, it surely would have been the TSN turning point. "Can I use your can, man?" said the delivery driver. Now here I am faced with a moral dilemma. Do I let this incontinent imbecile use my pisser or simply tell him to piss off? Was that even what he was asking me? I reasoned that he had brought me whiskey, even if he took his sweet time in doing so, and should he try to foul my anus, I could just break his head open and drink the whiskey from his lukewarm skull. Besides, if he emptied his bladder in the hallway, it might improve the smell of my building and my rent would probably go up. So I directed him to the facilities and sat down in my computer chair. He closed the door and began his visit at the urination station. I popped the cap from my bottle of whiskey and lifted the bottle to my lips. Then, just as the sweet nectar of the gods was about to hit my thirsty throat hole... What the fuck? Stop the train. Did this slack-jawed, sheep-smelling stranger really bring my booze at such a plodding pace, ask to use my washroom and then blow ass in my fucking apartment? I thought, you motherfucker, you soiled the sanctity of my fucking home. I stood up and prepared to give this flatulent, whiskey-pimping, inbred peasant a piece of my mind. And then it occurred to me, what would be the point? Was he gonna somehow unfart and vacuum-suck the vile vapor back up his anal cavity? I fucking doubt it. I mean, that would be pretty cool, but I doubt this cock breather possessed such a superpower. His apology wouldn't mean sweet fuck all, and I doubt he'd grasp the concept, let alone the finer points of etiquette. So, I just poured a long tumbler of whiskey down my neck and shook my head. He emerged from anally attacking my airspace, thanked me, and hastily retreated out the door. Based on his sudden exit, I thought he may have pilfered something from the bathroom, so I rushed to check inventory. I was not prepared for what I saw next. Good time for a tune, don't you think? This is Phantom 5 Crossfire on the Casey Ferguson Show. We'll be right back. Want more of The Casey Ferguson Show? You can download all episodes of the show at CaseyFergusonShow.com. Plus, bonus content, prize giveaways, polls, and much more, only at CaseyFergusonShow.com. One more time for the hard of hearing, that's CaseyFergusonShow.com.
You got a hold on me, I can hardly breathe. Girl, you got me twisted. Girl, you got me twisted. How to love when every day I'm lost and denying this unforgiving world you got us spinning in. And tell me where to find a little piece of my
pleasure beyond measure. You are listening to the Ron Jeremy of podcasts, The Casey Ferguson Show. From the forthcoming album Through Worlds of Stardust, that was Steelheart, You Got Me Twisted, and before that was Phantom 5 with Crossfire. Speaking of Crossfire, in the last break I was telling you about this gaseous Gomer Pyle looking delivery boy who made a speedy sprint out my door after having a frequency actuated rectal tremor in my damn bathroom. Motherfucker couldn't blow mud in his own house? God damn. Anyhow, that's not even the worst part. Did he steal anything? No. Did he leave a floater? No, he didn't shit, though one was clearly trying to whistle its way out. Even worse, he crop-dusted my roommate and confidant Doug McFly. How do I know? Because Doug lives in the bathroom, and when I poked my head in to check for thievery, he was lying lifeless on the tile floor. The free-floating anal vapors had knocked poor Doug right out of the air, and sent his hairy ass into a damn tailspin that ended in a crash landing. His pulse was weak, so I knew there was no time to spare. I hopped on the floor and began compressions on Doug's chest. I'm losing him, I thought. I knew I'd never live down the shame, but I sucked it up and performed mouth-to-mouth on my fallen friend. He sprung to life, flying erratically, eventually finding safety in the kitchen. Doug had to go on an oxygen mask for a while. That was pretty fucked up. Doug, what do you remember from that situation? Well, Doug, that was certainly more succinct than I put it. Never mind my breath, you're alive, ain't you? Anyhow, my next guest is illustrator and artist extraordinaire Tim Jacobus. Tim is best known for his work as the cover artist of the Goosebumps books. Come on, who doesn't remember Goosebumps? Since the release of its first novel, Welcome to Deadhouse, in July 1992, the series has sold over 350 million books worldwide in 32 languages, become a TV series, and even a film starring Jack Black. Don't worry, we'll get to discussing Goosebumps in the next part of our conversation, due out in October, but first, I wanted to get to know the man behind the art. His inspiration, his struggles, his philosophies. This is the first part of my interview with artist Tim Jacobus on The Casey Ferguson Show. Alright, this is Casey Ferguson. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. Perhaps the finest former salmon canner and sanitation engineer turned illustrator, Tim Jacobus, is on the phone. Welcome to the show, Tim. How are you?
Wow, I haven't heard the salmon canner reference in a long time. You did your homework.
Absolutely. Well, I didn't do any in elementary school or high school, so I figure I better get it in now, you know?
That's great.
So let's talk about the plethora of jobs you've had while you pursued your artistic endeavors, because success certainly didn't come overnight for you.
No, that's true. A lot of it was self-inflicted. It's self-inflicted conscious effort. What I was trying to do was I'm going to back up three more times. When I got out of art school, the portfolio that I had was a student portfolio. It was fine for, you know, someone who went to school, but I wanted to get into the book business and I wanted to bypass all those elementary steps that most of us took, which was, you know, either go work at an agency or maybe go work at a magazine, learn, you know, the ins and outs of that, and then gradually work yourself up into illustration and then move to book publishing. I just figured, well, I'm just going to go straight to book publishing, and in order to do that, my work has got to be a lot better than what I walked out of school with. So I spent the next couple of years putting together a professional portfolio. Now, I knew if I got myself a cushy job and I started to make some money that I might lose my edge, and I would quickly maybe, you know, start to go, well, I can paint tomorrow night. So I made sure that I had jobs that just weren't all that appealing. I made money, and I chose very physical jobs so that when I came home, I was tired, I was a little miserable, and it made me want to sit down and do my artwork and stay focused on it. So, yeah, salmon tanner, that was a beauty. during that salmon canning stint, we worked at a herring plant, and the herring boat had broken down out at sea, so the herring was 2 weeks old when it got into the dock. So,
oh, yummy.
Fantastic. I was a garbage man in the town that I grew up in for a few weeks. So, yeah, I did a little bit of everything. Construction, laborer, carried a lot of bricks and pails and plywood. So, yeah, it was, but again, you know, it made me want to sit down and do my artwork. So it all was worth it in the long run.
Well, there you go. Got to suffer for your art.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess so.
Now, Tim, I knew there was something very rock and roll about your work, and I finally figured it out the other night. You were very influenced by album art, right?
Oh, absolutely. Albums, you know, were king. I'm 58 years old. I graduated high school in 1977. Albums were, that was it. Those were, you know, your album collection dictated who you were as a human being. And album art was, you know, that was the modern day gallery. That's where you went and saw cool art. And there it was in the 12 by 12 format. And we all had bins of albums. And, you know, you studied them. You know, you studied them the way you study, you know, American illustrators like the Wyeths and whatnot. You studied your albums the same way. So, yeah, album art had a huge influence. And in particular was Roger Dean. Now, for the people who listen to you, maybe not 58 years old, Roger Dean did all the album covers for a band called Yes. did a lot of other bands as well, but that was his baby, and I just loved his artwork. And early on, even when I was in high school, I used to try to copy his artwork at the beginning, and I just liked his approach. My work does, may slightly resemble his stuff, not really, but it was more his way of thinking that really just truly inspired me.
Yeah, it's more so inspiration, right? I mean, you're not trying to steal the guy's whole oeuvre, but you're just kind of getting into it.
Yeah, but you look at his stuff, and it was his thought process, and it was the combination of living things and mechanical things at times, and he just looked at things different, and that's what you kept telling yourself was, all right, that's an interesting drawing you got going, but what can you do that's going to take it to the next level? So it's that mindset that I hope I got from him.
Of course, people are going to go back and look at those covers now for Goosebumps or something and see if they can see it. But I don't know, man, I've had this happen a couple times. I'll look at, it could be an actor, someone like yourself, and I'll go, that person's into music. I just know it. They're a rock and roller. And I don't know why that is, but I guess we sort of smell our own. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, music plays 24/7 here, and if it's not playing through a device, it's playing in my head. I don't work without music. It's a theme. It's I have my own soundtrack that's running every minute of every day.
Who have you been listening to?
That style of music, for lack of better terms, they call it prog rock. It was made big back in the 70s, and that was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, and Pink Floyd, and that's where it got its start. Currently, the guys that I admire greatly who are doing their own version of that is Steven Wilson, and he played for years.
Porcupine Tree.
Porcupine Tree, yeah. And, just fantastic. The guy is amazing. Porcupine Tree music is amazing, and it's a band here, at least, in the States that doesn't get a lot of traction, but are amazing. And, they're one that really, they always catch my ear. Steven Wilson just released something either Monday or Friday or just this week. I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but I'm gonna go out on a limb and say it's probably pretty good.
Chicken, chicken, yeah!
Well, you actually designed a couple album covers, did you not?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just finished one, and it's getting ready for release, the next couple of weeks. It's a band called The Undead. The main guy in the band is one of the original members of The Misfits. I'm going to just kind of, I hate categorizing people because they hate it too, but they're kind of in the Alice Cooper mode. It's real basic rock and roll. They have that goth edge to them, but it's a little bit, there's a little tongue-in-cheek there as well. Super nice people. Yeah, so that'll be coming out soon, and that'll be the most current one. I did a couple, over the years. Oh yeah, Suicide. Yeah, those guys were out of Australia. That was a fun one. I did a band called out of Boston called Ravage. That was more of typical heavy metal. There's another guy who was just a good dude. I'm walking around now trying to look for the actual albums on my shelf because I can't remember anything.
I got the memory of a budgie bird, man. I understand.
And then this other guy, Shadow Windhawk and the Morticians. These guys have the blood poured on them, and it was fun to go see them too. Again, all this stuff is a little bit different music than I'm used to, but good people. It's funny, this guy Shadow Windhawk, when you see him, he's the scariest looking dude you ever saw. Couldn't be a nicer human being. I work with creative directors at ad agencies where super expensive three-piece suits, and they're the real monsters in the world.
Nailed it! Well, that's awesome that you're getting to do that. I mean, are you looking to do more of that sort of thing, album designs, or are you just kind of like whatever comes in?
Yeah, it's why. Yeah, I like that because the people in bands are very passionate about what they do. I do a lot of corporate work, and there's nothing wrong with corporate work, but a lot of times it's not overly inspired. Where I'll work on with a smaller budget to do something that's fun and. And I get called upon from time to time, and usually everybody can afford to pay. I'm not overly expensive, but there are times where they come and they say, listen, I'm a little bit short, and we make it happen just because I know I'm going to have a good time. And I'll probably end up going out and seeing them play a couple times and force my ass out of the house.
Well, we all have to do that from time to time. I'm notorious for, I think people think I'm borderline agoraphobic, and I think I'm starting to believe it myself.
Exactly. 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 Yeah. It's very easy to stay propped in front of your work and keep working, but it's also, you know, got to get out.
Well, so they keep telling me.
Natural light! Get it off me! Get it off me!
Have you had a lot of offers to do, like, poster or box art for movies or something? Because I would think that would be, like, a natural extension of what you do.
Yeah, no, never movies. Never once in all the years.
Really?
Never been approached for a movie poster.
I'm sorry, I'm like, I can't even fathom that. If there's any directors or producers, or I know a few of you guys are listening out there that are filmmakers, get a hold of Tim. What the hell is wrong with the world where no one is approaching you to do a damn movie poster?
I blame the government.
Jesus.
It's funny, it's like anything else, you get categorized, and, you know, I got known for being a paperback artist, and, you know, it was hard to break out of that mold. It's easier now, people are a little more forward thinking, but there was a time where I had a hard time even getting a hardback book, because I was a paperback cover artist. So, it happens. I'm open to anything. I very rarely will turn down a job because of what type of work it is. I'll design and create whatever the end use is, within reason, you know.
Well, hell, I'll write a damn movie just to have you do the poster. Might not be any good, but, you know.
Yeah, but I promise we'll do good. We'll have the most awesome poster, though.
Yeah, the poster will look sweet. The movie will be a piece of shit. But
Sharks in space. In theaters everywhere, September 31st.
I don't know. I've rented a couple movies at the, you know, the video store that I was like, wow, I don't understand what went wrong. This cover was so good. You know, so I figure if I fell for it, some other idiot will, you know.
I took in a movie, an appalling little piece of filth. Its leading lady was a blonde harlot who spent half the film strolling around naked as a jaybird. No, oh, just give the great unwashed a pair of oversized breasts and a happy ending, and they'll oink for more every time.
What a movie! And that blonde cutie, does she have assets?
Sounds like my kind of flick.
And how?
Here's one for you, because again, I like, maybe it might be different from the whole rock and roll thing, but sometimes I see you know, other things in people's work. Were you influenced by Famous Monsters or EC Comics or anything like that?
When we were kids, it was early on in the comic book world. The guy next door to me, my best friend, his name was Drew. Drew had all older brothers, and they had all the comic books. You know, again, we're going back in the caveman days, and they did a lot of the. This was even prior to, you know, Batman being. You know, Batman was out, but it wasn't that cool. They were more into like Sergeant Rock, and, you know, the army style comic books. So we used to take when they were done with them, you know, we would sneak their comic books out, and of course they beat us up, and, you know, they caught us.
A sixth grader chased with his bike, and I was running. When I got exhausted and fell down, he railed me with his shoe.
But we, you know, would read through them one time, but then immediately both him and I would be breaking out the pencils and trying to copy the artwork that we saw inside these comic books. So, yeah, comic books definitely had an influence on me, because when you look at comic books, especially as a kid, you see that 2D art broken down into a very simplistic form, and all of a sudden you go, oh, it's only, you know, four lines that make that up, and if I could copy those four lines, I could draw that too. And you find out that those four lines are very difficult to do, realization that kind of gets the wheels turning.
Well, it's just like blues music, right? A lot of people think, oh, I mean, it's only three chords. How hard could it be to play? It's not as easy as it looks, kids. Not as easy as it looks.
Absolutely. And then when you see it done well, it's amazing. You know, it's funny. I use the analogy for the Goosebumps covers that it's a lot like cooking. You know, it's like Mexican food. I'm using the same ingredients, basically, but I'm doing, putting them together in a little bit different way, and I'm hoping that it tastes a little bit different, but it's still kind of the same, but I'm just working that recipe. And, you know, there's a little bit of that in, I think, all art forms, not copying, but it's, you know, it's playing with the ingredients until you get them just right or you make them yours.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. That was the first part of my interview with artist Tim Jacobus. I'll have more from that conversation this October, so be sure to keep an eye out for that. For all things Tim, head over to timjacobus.com. I'm going to send this next track out to Tim because I have a feeling he'll dig it, and hopefully, so will you. This is Howlin' Giant, the Pioneer, on The Casey Ferguson Show.
Transmissions down. Hey, this is Greg from Ash Forest Hi-Fi. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show.
Amongst sweaty sheets,
Killer, no filler. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. From the album Closure, that was Odna with Leave, Secret Company in there as well with Final Wish, and at the top of the set was Howling Giant with The Pioneer. It's almost time for me to blaze a trail, Wildcats, but before I go, I reckon there's at least a few of you out there that, like myself, haven't gotten to do a fucking thing all summer. Now, I don't want to complain too much because in some ways it's been a good summer. I got lots of work done, listened to some great music, and had the opportunity to interview some really incredible people. But it certainly wasn't the summer that I had planned. I was going to take some trips, take in some concerts, spend time with the people I care about, and even kick back and relax. Well, it didn't work out that way. So I'm going to try and salvage what's left of summer with a few events, and if your summer's been anything like mine, perhaps you'll consider checking this shit out too. First up, I'll be covering the 5th annual Kingston Rib Fest and Craft Beer Show, September 8th, 9th, and 10th at Memorial Center Park. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and a bracelet is just $6, which includes a souvenir 5-ounce sample glass. Samples are just $2, and there are 15 craft breweries taking part this year. There's something like 60 different beers, ciders, and coolers being sampled, and while I won't be able to try all of them, I assure you it won't be due to lack of effort. I'll probably eat my body weight in cornbread again this year, but hey, you gotta do something to soak up all that booze. For more information, check out KingstonRibAndBeerFest.com. I'll also be the MC of Voodoo Rock Fest again this year at Napanee Fairgrounds Friday, September 22nd and Saturday, September 23rd. Well, I guess that's sort of fall, but what the fuck ever. Lots of killer rock bands you've heard on this show, such as Last Bullet and Sweet Talk Jackie, will be performing. There's also tributes to Guns N' Roses, Skid Row, and Green Day, as well as beer, camping, and food trucks. A weekend pass is just $50, and that includes your campsite. I was definitely honored to be asked to return as MC this year, so I'm looking forward to Voodoo Rock Fest. For a full lineup or to purchase tickets, head over to the festival section of musicfly.ca or hit the Voodoo Rock Fest page on Facebook. I figure my Czech liver light will be on after those two events, but hell, I have to make up for the summer I didn't have, right? Well, that's it for me, Wildcats. I'd like to thank my guests, Dan Severn and Tim Jacobus. Thanks to all the bands and the reps for sending me some great music to play for all of you. Thank you to my sponsors, and of course, thank you for listening. Sync In will play us out with a track called Tell the Kids. Remember, in the realm of ideas, everything depends on enthusiasm. In the real world, all rests on perseverance. Until next time, this is Casey Ferguson, over and out.
Dear Mother, I wonder where you are tonight. It's been several weeks since you've been home before my bedtime. I think about the promise that you said you'd keep, that the monsters would never get to me when I go to sleep. But, How can you protect me when you're not by my side? And Daddy's in the other room, trying not to cry. He said something about you, and it made me nervous. Like, what am I supposed to say to her? She doesn't deserve this. Last week he yelled at you, and he called you weak. When you put my sister down to grab those pills you eat. He opens up my bedroom door and he sits down, as the monsters creep from under my bed now.
Love of mine, how could you do this? How selfish could you be to put the little ones through this? Did you forget that they need someone to depend on now? I bet it didn't run through your mind when you were going out. Oh, I get it, these pills take the place of family, don't they? And the needles drain your worries so that you feel okay. But tell me, what are they supposed to tell their friends now when they ask them why their mommy hasn't been around? I walk in, the bedroom is dim and lit. Echoes in my brain again. And I know the pain has brought you down to this. But next time, make sure you go and tell the kids.